The night has fallen. I'm lying awake. I can feel myself fading away. So receive me, brother, with your faithless kiss, or will we leave each other alone like this on the streets of Philadelphia? I don't know how many Bruce Springsteen fans we have here today, but if you are one, I'm sure you'll instantly recognize those words as the last verse of his number one hit, The Streets of Philadelphia, back in the mid-1990s. It's a pretty melancholy, sad song, which sums up the desperation felt by those suffering with HIV/AIDS in Philadelphia, USA, at the end of the 20th century. And as we look at the passage that Christine read for us this morning, and we see what John wrote in Revelation chapter 3, we can see that the Christians in Philadelphia, in the Roman province of Asia, were feeling equally desperate at the suffering they were going through at the end of the first century AD. The reasons may have been very different, but the suffering was the same. They had little strength, we're told in verse 8. So things were really, really tough for them. Why is that? Well, for starters, Philadelphia was right at the heart of the earthquake region. And the quakes were so frequent and dangerous that many had chosen to live in huts in the fields outside the main city as it was safer there. But for the Christians, that was only a small part of the problem. The big issue for them was that there were a lot of other religions in the city, none of which had any time for Christianity. Philadelphia had been built initially by the Greeks to spread the Greek language and culture, and it was known as Little Athens, with loads of grand temples and buildings all around. And along with this, of course, came the worship of all the Greek gods, with the fertility gods being particularly prominent, given that it was the center of the wine region. Then you got the coming of the Romans, and there was the new cult of emperor worship. And the city had actually adopted a new name, Neo Caesarea, when Tiberius offered to rebuild it after yet another earthquake. And then finally, of course, there were the Jews, who they stuck steadfastly to the ways of traditional Judaism, and they refused to accept what was a new sect of Christianity, rejecting it as blasphemy. So basically, whichever way you looked, the worship of Jesus Christ wasn't a safe option. The Christians were ostracized and thoroughly persecuted for their faith, not having anywhere to turn for comfort. So, both the Christian community in Philadelphia, Asia, in the first century, and the HIV/AIDS community in Philadelphia, USA, in the 20th century, were isolated, persecuted, and almost dead on their feet. But that's where the similarity ends. Actually, another couple of lines in the Springsteen song, just before the final verse, which go, "Ain't no angel gonna greet me, it's just you and I, my friend." But you see, that wasn't really true for the Christians. For them, redemption was at hand. Because for them, this letter wasn't just an angel greeting them, it was far more than that. It was the risen Jesus himself. And it wasn't actually just a greeting, it was a promise, or actually not just any old promise, but a series of promises, each phrased in such a way that Jesus was demonstrating that he knew the intimate details of their suffering and that he cared about it. So let's take a brief look at some of the details. It's a little bit like looking at the small print of a contract. In this case, the small print's full of good news rather than bad news. Because, see, to start with, Jesus wanted to give them the confidence that he really was in charge, just in case they'd started to doubt it. So he describes himself in verse 7, if you've got the Bible open there, as being holy and true, which, of course, is in contrast to all the false gods that were abounding in Philadelphia. And, of course, in contrast to the liars from the synagogue of Satan that he describes in verse 9. Now, the synagogue of Satan is quite a difficult one. There's plenty of suggestions about who they were. No one's really certain. They've been mentioned before, if you've been here for the last few weeks, back in the letter to Smyrna. That's chapter 2, verse 9. And you can see there's quite a lot of similarities between Smyrna and Philadelphia if you scan through. But in the absence of any certainty, I reckon the simplest way to look at it is this. On the one hand, you've got the Jews claiming that the Christians are liars because they're saying Jesus is the Messiah. And then on the other, you've got the Christians, who they're actually the ones telling the truth, and yet it's really the Jews who are lying, not the Christians. So, and in doing so, they're doing Satan's work in the process. So they're liars and the synagogue of Satan. That might not be the whole story, but I don't think anybody knows the whole story. So at least it's enough to get the gist of what's being said here. But anyway, going back to verse 7, Jesus then goes on to emphasize his authority even more. He's got this little phrase, the key of David, which you'll see there. Now, that refers back to a prophecy in Isaiah chapter 22, which is probably just worth a little look. It's on page 706, so keep one finger in Revelation 3 and go back to page 706. Very simply, it's a prophecy of judgment against the Jews and their leaders. And it talks about how God's servant, Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, is going to replace the disgraced Shebna. So if we pick it up in verse 20, Isaiah 22, verse 20. In that day, it goes there, I will summon my servant Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him with your robe and fasten your sash around him and hand your authority over to him. He will be a father to those who live in Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. I will place on his shoulder the key to the house of David. What he opens, no one can shut. And what he shuts, no one can open. Exactly the same words that you read in Revelation 3. So you can see that Jesus is using very, very carefully chosen language to show that he's the one with authority. He's the one who's opening a door that no one can shut. And the Christians have, after all, got it right. But verse 7 isn't, and the surroundings, it's not the only place where you can see Jesus comforting the Christians in the small print. In fact, you can actually work your way through almost every phrase in the prophecy you've got there and claim that it's pointing to something specific. I haven't got time to do them all. The odd one or two may be a little bit fanciful. I've read quite a few things that people suggest. But there are some pretty obvious, significant ones which are worth mentioning. Most obvious in verse 12, actually, which is a pretty long verse. Have a look at verse 12. In the first part, you see, you've got the promise that he who overcomes will become a pillar in a temple, but not just a Greek temple in the city of Philadelphia or even the fairly recently destroyed temple in Jerusalem, much loved by the law-obsessed Jews, but instead they're going to become a pillar in the temple of God himself. And what's more, they're told it's a temple they'll never have to leave, unlike the constant flight from earthquakes that the citizens of Philadelphia experienced. And of course, even more than that, it's a temple that just can't be touched by an earthquake. It's rock solid, totally indestructible. So that's the first bit of verse 12, and then the second half. There's all those names there you can read. They're given to the person who overcomes, the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, and my new name. Lots of names, and every one of them in a different league to Little Athens or Neo Caesarea or any other name that Philadelphia was known by. There were quite a few others, apparently. So, you know, specific words, specifically chosen for the Christians in Philadelphia to know what was really going on. And it's difficult to imagine how they must have felt when they heard all of this. They were out on their feet, but every word spoken was geared towards saying, I know you personally. I've seen your suffering. You're doing a great job, not much longer, and you're going to be with me forever. Yeah, it's a bit like telling the marathon runner they've almost made it. You know, the finishing tape's just around the corner. Just keep going round the bend and you're there. That's the sort of picture we've got. So it was fantastic news for them. But as we've seen already in this series, the little phrase in verse 13, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, implies that Jesus isn't just speaking to the first century Philadelphians. He's saying something to all Christians through all ages. So we've got to say to ourselves, what is he saying which is timeless? And how should we apply that today in the 21st century in the West End of London? Now, there's lots of things you can suggest here. You can say, if you're having a hard time, God will be with you. And I think that's true. Or you can say, if you're having a hard time because of your Christian faith, then God will be with you. That's probably a little more accurate. But you see, I'm just slightly wary going straight for this. It's certainly massively tempting and perfectly reasonable to draw parallels between the worship of the gods of wine and fertility in Philadelphia and the worships of the gods of wine and fertility in London as well. But the problem I've got is that whatever pressures we may face today, the consequences of taking a stand here are far less dangerous than they were in Philadelphia. So there's just that little bit where it's, you know, there is a fair application there, but it's not a perfect one. We have to bear in mind it's nothing here in comparison to the sort of situation they were facing there. But then you can move off on another tack, and you can say that the passage teaches us we should learn to be more prayerful for those who suffer under persecution in the church. And there's no doubt that's true. And sadly, you don't have to look far to find terrible examples of people facing persecution today. The example I'm about to tell you isn't that terrible, but it's not great. A few weeks ago, I was chatting to a guy called Theo, who's one or two of you may know him. He's one of the All Souls apprentices this year, who's Greek. And I asked him what his experiences were as a Christian, an evangelical Christian, growing up in Greece. And he said it was pretty tough, because he said the first thing you had to realize was that you weren't considered to be a real Greek. Because to be Greek meant you had to be Orthodox. But there's so much about the Orthodox Church in Greece, I don't know whether you know much about it, but there's so much that the evangelicals just can't accept some of the things that they believe. So that just leaves them as outcasts. They're treated as a cult and not real Greeks at all. Pretty much like, actually, the synagogue of Satan in this passage, rejecting the Jewish Christians as real Jews. Anyway, I then asked him whether he'd seen any warnings of persecution happening here as well. And interestingly, he said yes, he did feel that the warning signs were starting in London. So I guess that's another message that we could take from the passage, that we can see it as a warning of what we could face in the future. In fact, if you read through the Bible and you look around the world, I reckon you can almost say that the normal state for the Christian is to be under persecution. I don't think that's too much of an exaggeration. I'm not at all saying that we should welcome that, because I think the message of Jesus is that the power of recreation and renewal has broken in. So we should welcome and expect evidence of that in the here and now. But the whole point is, this process isn't going to be fully realized until Jesus comes back again. In the letter to the Romans, Paul tells us that the whole creation is still groaning. So, sure, we shouldn't welcome persecution, but we should expect it and be prepared for it. So there's all those points there that can reasonably be made as things to be learnt from the passage. But as I thought about it, you know, none of them really sum up the main message which is there, which we've read. So I thought, what is it that Jesus is saying to all Christians in all circumstances through all time from his words to the church in Philadelphia? And in the end, I decided it was this. It's very, very simple. Don't be afraid. Because the point is that the church in Philadelphia isn't being congratulated for being persecuted. In some ways, it's being congratulated for holding on under and holding firm under persecution. But even here, we've got to be a little bit careful in case we go down the route that they're being justified before God because of their works. So ultimately, the message isn't one of congratulation. It's more a message of comfort and encouragement. And what he's saying is, don't be afraid of the earthquakes, of the Romans, the synagogue of Satan, or anybody. I'm the one who's really in charge, however things may appear. And of course, it's the same message that's echoed down the ages to believers all the way through the Bible. If you think back to the book of Joshua, there's a phrase that keeps on being repeated. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. And if you think all the way through the Gospels, the same line so many times, hold your nerve, don't be afraid. Probably most obvious in John's Gospel. John, who's writing this. If you just think of the long section after the Lord's Supper, chapters 14 to 17, all the way through, their constant reassurance. You've got the disciples frightened about what's going on, but reassurance. John 14, verse 27, just one example. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not be afraid. So it's echoed down to believers through all ages, and it echoes down to us. From Philadelphia in the first century. And the point is, It's a message that cuts across every level of fear and every level of suffering. And primarily, it's given to us to encourage us to stand up for our faith in whatever circumstances we're in. Back in 1997, I was working in Swindon for my sins for an American company, and we were being sold off by the Americans. And I was actually being offered the chance to remain with the company and go to France. I'd pretty well accepted that. I'd gone over and had a look, and I'd virtually said yes. But right at the last minute, we started to have second thoughts, and the prospect of going to theological college emerged instead. Now, for various reasons, I was pretty sure I was being called to a significant change in circumstances. Now, I had the inkling it might be a little bit daunting. But it was only when we were walking home from church one Sunday, and a friend said to me, which of the two options are going to be hardest for you emotionally? I instantly realized that it would be really hard to tell people that I was going to go to theological college. Now, that may not seem very daunting to you, and I'm not really sure I can explain it properly, but I guess it felt like I was sort of blowing my cover. It wasn't as if I'd been hiding my faith away, exactly. I'd been with my company for 10 years or so. I reckon most people there who knew me knew I went to church, and I'd had specific conversations with a number of people about my faith, and I'd even had one training course where I'd had to take a bit of a stand when I felt we were almost sort of dabbling in the occult, what we were being encouraged to do. So I don't think I could be accused of hiding in the closet at all. But there was something about going to theological college that really nailed my colours to the mast. It was like I was saying, look, this is what I believe, in a way that nobody could fail to see. And of course, it wasn't just at work, it was with friends and family, and probably toughest of all, actually, my sports club. Not a great place to admit you're a Christian in that way. So there was no hiding place at all. And it just felt a little bit scary. So you may not think that being exposed as a card-carrying radical Christian is very scary, because not everybody does. But I reckon a number of you would do, particularly if up until now people have seen you as relatively normal. You see, it doesn't actually matter that most of us here aren't going to be facing the death threat for saying we follow Jesus Christ in the way they did in Philadelphia, because the fear is still there. I know it and you know it. And for me, actually, it's just as much there as a sort of professional Christian working in Christian circles as it was when I was an accountant working in the commercial world. It doesn't go away. So what do we do about it? Well, I reckon the best place to start is by being honest. Has that fear of talking about your faith sometimes meant you've kept quiet when you should have said something? Have you ever found yourself lying or sort of being economic with the truth a little bit, as you just couldn't find the right words to say or the right time to say it? And did you feel awful about it afterwards? Well, we've all been there. For all I know, you may even have been there this morning. Now, when that happens to you, whatever you do, don't let it squash you. Repent of it, yes, but don't let the guilt get to you. Because I reckon the Christians in Philadelphia would have buckled under the pressure more than once. And of course, if you want any further comfort, you can always think back to that most famous liar, Peter, back in the Garden of Gethsemane. He was rebuked, but he wasn't condemned, and neither are we. Because you see, the thing is, the issue of sharing our faith is just a little bit too important to ignore. Because one day, as we sung about it, one day, Jesus is going to return. And on that day, all of us are going to stand before him, and all the arguments will cease. So when your friends or your family or your colleagues say to you, well, I don't agree with you, you know, you've got your opinion, I've got mine, treat them with respect, sure, but don't lose sight of the reality. The reality is that what they think isn't going to cut any ice on the day that Jesus returns, because opinions aren't going to count for anything anymore. We'll all know the truth because he's going to be standing there right in front of us. Now, some may say that's arrogant and triumphalistic, but actually nothing could be farther from the truth, because it's actually very sad. Because there are bound to be people that I care about and people who you care deeply about who are going to come face to face with Jesus and realize that they spent their life rejecting him. So do we need any further incentive to overcome our fears and share our faith in Jesus, however inadequately we may do it? I'm not saying fear of judgment is the best reason for testifying to our faith. I think our desire for God's glory and pleasing him should really be where it starts. And I'm not necessarily saying you start with judgments in explaining to people who Jesus is in a mixed-up world where a sense of absolute right and wrong has largely vanished. But it is such a crucial issue. And if we forget about it or ignore it, we're missing out on the most fundamental piece of the jigsaw. So, encouragement, that might feel a touch scary. But we have to remember this message is mainly one of encouragement. We need to remember Jesus' key message, do not be afraid. Bruce Springsteen may be called the boss, but he's not the Messiah. Ain't no angel going to greet me, it's just you and I, my friend. Doesn't have to be the whole truth. Jesus comes to open blind eyes today, the same as he always has. And amazingly, he chooses you and he chooses me to help him do it in the same way he chose his disciples to do it, even when he was with them on the earth. Do not be afraid, he said to them. Do not be afraid, he says to us as well. These are the words of him who is holy and true. I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I'm coming soon. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches.